Okay, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Great googly moogly, another week is upon us. It is the 21st day of March 2016. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to join in the real-time multimedia frenzy that is the Horn chat room, where we carry on and cuss and discuss in real time during the portion of the program that is live every night during, you know, the live broadcast itself, which, by the way, and I guess I'm not real clear on this sometimes, is 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time here in the new United States of Merca and everything that goes with it. Yes. So, yeah, just pick yourself out a screen name and a password, jump right in, and you'll be part of all the merriment. I myself am attempting to become part of all the merriment at the moment, and we shall see in short order if I'm going to have any luck, you know, doing that. I don't know yet. We're working, but hopefully I'll be in the chat room, and I'll know who's in the chat room in a relative short period of time. This is, of course, a listener-supported broadcast. We try to raise $200 every evening. This evening is no different at all. We're going to try to raise 10 at 20, 20 at 10, 1 at 200, 2 at 100, 4 at 50, 8 at 25, 16 at 12, 50, 32 at 6 and a quarter, or 64 at $3.13, because we round up when we run into those odd numbers. You know, odd numbers for odd people, like, you know, me. Speaking of me, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And yes, it is Moran Monday on the Horn, and we have them in rich abundance this evening. Oh my God, we do, we really, really do. If you want to help with the aforementioned fundraising, just run over to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, click on the tab called Contribute, and there you will find an interface where you put in your name, your address. What else? Well, I can tell you what you don't have to put in. There's a couple of fields there asking what you do and who you do it for, and, well, frankly, what you do for Mr. Drucker down at the general store in Hooterville is just between you and Mr. Drucker. So you can leave that blank and just get to the next screen. It's always all about getting to the next screen. Well, diddly damn. Tom tells me I'm getting Rick Smith. Well, you shouldn't be. Okay, so I got to go fix that. Hold on. There I go again. Yeah, I get myself all excited to do the program. It's been a couple of days, you know, the week is over, blah, 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 blah. And then, well, you know, can't get on the air. Stand by. So we'll just sort of sit here and wait while I'll find out. Okay, you're good now, Bob. Thank you, Sparky. Thank you very kindly. All right, all right. We are go. Let's see. Let me send a message to Rick. All right, so it's not... Yeah, okay, so we are golden. We are Stardust. We are golden. And we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. All right. Yeah, Carol tells me I've got you. Had Rick until 5:04. Okay. But nevertheless, we are on the air, and if you want to help us keep this whole thing going, go over to headonradionetwork.com. Go to contribute. Do your thing. Or if you prefer the United States Postal Service, you can send in a contribution by mail. I really appreciate it when you let me know that you're doing that, so that I can tell Boss Man Wayne to keep an eye out for it. That mailing it just send me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com, and then I'll tell Boss Man Wayne, and that means he can leave his spider-proof gloves in the truck when he reaches into the echo chamber at the UPS store. Where both the Horn and the Klan go to get their mail, and we still haven't figured out why UPS is allowing its agents to do business with a terrorist organization. Maybe someday we will. Who knows? The intrepid journalists over at WOAY-TV, whose highest rated single program ever used to be when it produced live wrestling. They tried to do a little newsy piece on the Klan and stuff, and they even interviewed my buddy Brian Reznor for it. But oddly enough, they didn't ask any journalism questions. Things like going to the proprietor of the UPS store and saying, "Why are you doing business with a terrorist organization?" "Well, I can't not do business with them." Actually, you can. You really can. They're not. The Klan is not fucking protected under any. No, they're not. Yo, but anyway, expecting poor little WOAY to do any real journalism. You don't hold your breath. So, yeah, more in Monday, right? And suddenly we're talking about the Klan. It all fits together. But before we jump into the Morans. Before we do that, I've got some good news. I don't know if anybody else has been talking about this good news today, but I find it to be good news. Bernie Sanders has won the global primary of Democrats living abroad. I didn't realize there was a global primary of Democrats living abroad. I thought everybody just kind of voted in their home precinct and mailed in. I've never been a global Democrat, and I've never lived abroad, so you see what I know. But nonetheless, he did, and he did it convincingly. Turnout among global Democrats living abroad was up 50% from 2008. Now, you can break that number down however you wish. In my particular case, I think, 34,570 U.S. citizens living in 38 countries voted by internet, mail, fax, or in person. And in the global primary of Democrats living abroad, Bernie Sanders whooped. I mean, whooped. Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. He got 69% of the vote. It earned him 9 delegates to the National Convention in Philly this August. And Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton got 31% of the vote and earned 4 delegates. That says something. Consider the breakdown. This is really quite interesting. The story coming from The Guardian. And I think it makes for an interesting discussion, if you care to, later in the program. Which reminds me, it is. I need to check the stress line and make sure that that is working properly. Yeah, for pity's sakes, we had updates come through today, didn't we? Yes, we did. And next. But the number breakouts, I think, are telling. Check this out. There were seven, and, you know, considering most of the people in most of the Americans in Afghanistan are in the military, maybe this says as much about our military as it does about Afghanistan or whatever, but there were seven Democrats voting abroad in Afghanistan. At least who voted. In Afghanistan, where we have done everything in our power to reduce that country to rubble, to impose democracy at the muzzle of a gun. Yeah. Well, of the seven Democrats who voted in the Democrats Living Abroad primary, five of them voted for Bernie Sanders. Five out of seven. That's pretty good. Actually, that's extraordinarily good. Now, it means next to nothing to Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. You know, five humble international Democrats voting for Bernie. Seven total votes in Afghanistan. Here's where it gets more interesting. Consider Australia, where we have expats. For instance, we've got one Australian expat who's not ex right now. I'm sure I'm not within the reach of her voice. I know she's somewhere working for Bernie. But remember, Jennifer picked up bag and baggage, kissed Graham goodbye, scratched a cat behind the ears, got on a plane in Perth, and I guess you got to go from Perth to Sydney and then from Sydney to... But she well, I think she's in Pennsylvania right now, working for Bernie. But consider these numbers out of Australia. Out of a total of 873 voters in Australia, Bernie Sanders got 635 of the votes. And Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton got 237. That is a curb stomping. That's huge. Then there's Japan. Americans living abroad in Japan, who are Democrats and voting, gave a heady 1,178 votes to Bernie Sanders. They gave to Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton 176. In Japan, Democratic voters, Americans living abroad, gave 1,002 more votes to Bernie Sanders than they did to Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. Down in Mexico, it wasn't quite as big. But Bernie won there, too. 838 for Bernie to 545 for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. And finally, let's see. Yep. About as close as it got was the UK. But even in the UK, Bernie beat Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton, taking 2,874 votes out of 4,610 cast. Yeah. Pretty interesting, don't you think? I mean, I'm happy for any victory that Bernie gets. As I'm sure you are. But that's... Why do you suppose that those numbers are so wildly at odds with the trend here in the United States? I mean, among other things, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton has been Secretary of State. She's been at the helm of the foreign policy of the United States of America.
The greatest country in the world on earth, now, today, forever in the universe. Amen. In God we trust. Hallelujah. Under God.
So you'd think that people living abroad would have a, you know, they'd say, well, golly, we certainly must vote for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton, for she has been Secretary of State, and lo, yea, verily, here we are living outside the United States. We are walking manifestations of American foreign policy. Or maybe that's why? I find it fascinating. And I think it quite the interesting conversation. You tell me. So one, congratulations to Bernie for building a campaign that is that inspiring to Americans scattered all around the globe. In country after country after country. And then, I mean, well, I mean, 38 different countries with a 50% increase in turnout from 2008. 34,570 voters. That's a, you know what? That would be the third or fourth largest city in West Virginia. And they voted resoundingly for Senator Bernie Sanders. What do you make of that? What does that mean? Could it be, and you know what, this would be an excellent time for, and in the next 24 hours or so, because a lot of, if you're abroad, if you're in a foreign country, especially if you are to the east of the United States, I know it's a circular, well, it's sort of a squished ellipsis kind of, but it's a round planet. So everything's to the east of the United States and everything's to the west of the United States, but I'm thinking about time zones. Odds are you are not listening if you are in Europe right now, unless you're kind of, you know, insomniac, or maybe you work nights. But it's morning. Yeah, it's 11:21 a.m. In Australia? And what, 9:21 a.m. in Japan? And we have expat listeners in both countries. But we've also got expat listeners in Germany, the UK, Ireland, Scotland, the various and sundry countries of Scandinavia. Hi, our buddy Scott. We got Michael in Norway. We've got and we've got native listeners as well. We've got listeners in the UAE. I mean, it kind of, by the way, this is just a program note, or a reminder, I suppose. I have started putting the podcast up over at Podbean, PODBEAN.com. By the way, I'm still not in the chat room. Go figure. But I've started putting, the podcast over at podbean.com. And I learned something new. We've got, the vast majority of listeners, Podbean listeners, members of the community in the United States. But we also have, and this applies to Podbean only, it doesn't apply to the broader reach of the program, but on Podbean, we've got listeners in the United States, we've got them in the United Arab Emirates, we have them in Canada. The United Arab Emirates and Canada are tied. India. Now, in India's sunny clime, where I used to spend my time, a servant of Her Majesty the Queen, India. We've actually got more Podbean listeners in India than we do in Spain, and that's the limits of our Podbean listeners right now. United States, Canada, United Arab Emirates, Canada, India, and Spain, which I just, you know, like I said, I just kind of find fascinating. But could it be? And you are welcome to chime in now if you're in the morning part of the world, or overnight if you're in the part of the world that is busy being 24 minutes past midnight, et cetera. Could it be that the reason... A specific reason why the international contingent of Democrats went so solidly for Bernie is because Americans living abroad, especially in developed countries, can see for themselves firsthand the benefits of the programs and systems about which Bernie so frequently speaks. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. People living in countries where if a person gets sick and needs to go to the doctor, they don't have to worry about being bankrupted. Well, I can see where if I were an American living abroad, I'd look at that and say, I want that for my country too. I mean, there are people living in foreign countries who can't come back home because this place is more brutal by an exponential amount than the country in which they live. And I rather think that's as good an explanation as any for why Bernie so thoroughly trounced Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton in the among Democrats living abroad. If you are in Germany, if you are in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, then you see up close at first hand the value of young qualified people being able to go to college and not exit college crippled in debt. I remember my own experience of a few years back hanging out with some college-age students. Some of them were working on their master's degree in various universities in Germany. And I said, because I was just being an ignorant American, so was it hard to get in? Yes. I mean, we're talking about master's degree programs. So are you going to be in terrible debt when you come out? No. Because there is a base level recognition in these more enlightened cultures that having an educated populace is a net positive. That having an educated population is a benefit to the people of that country generally. And so when the choice is between a candidate who says, yes, we can, and yes, we must, and a candidate who says, no, we can't, never, ever, we're not Denmark, maybe, just maybe, people who are watching that sort of thing up close and seeing the societal benefits, maybe the choice becomes downright easy for them. You think? Meanwhile, back here in the United States, and I think this is where we begin moving over into the moron part of the program. Meanwhile, back here in the United States, Bernie Sanders does continue to campaign. Bernie Sanders is not campaigning as though he thinks, here I am, early 70s, got nothing better to do. Might as well go from state to state delivering speeches about economic inequality and hope for the future, because it beats the out of Parcheesi. Really don't think that's why Bernie's campaigning that way. Bernie Sanders intends to be the Democratic nominee for the presidency of the United States in the general election in November of 2016. And he is campaigning like it. He has spoken profoundly in states whose primaries are upcoming. He delivered an impassioned speech in Arizonistan, in which he said plainly and unequivocally that it is absolutely necessary that we, the people, through our elected representatives, make good on the broken promises we have made to the indigenous peoples of this continent. That we start trying to extend the American dream to those in the native communities who want it. Or that we simply start making it more viable for native communities to live successfully in the ways that have been successful for them, you know, for millennium upon millennium upon millennium upon millennia upon millennia. Right. And of course, Washington State caucuses on Saturday. And that will be quite a prize. And I sincerely hope, and it's important. It is important that Bernie not just win in Washington, but that he win going away. He needs to deliver a few trouncings like he did in Minnesota and Colorado. Just a minute here. Because I want to run some audio for you. And here in particular is the audio that I want to run. And I'm doing it for a very good reason. This is the closing of the remarks that Bernie made in his rally in Seattle. Now, the venue where he spoke was filled to capacity, and there was an even larger overflow crowd outside. So all told, Bernie Sanders, and they had viewing for outside. I mean, everybody got right. So something on the order of 34,000 people turned out on a rainy Sunday in Seattle, and about half of those stood out in the rain. Stood out in the rain to hear delivered a message not just of national hope, but of national salvation. A message that we can, in fact, change a system that brutalizes everyone but the richest of the rich in this country. that if we want it, we can have a system that says that every person who needs to go to the doctor can do so and not worry about being bankrupt to doing it. That interested young people with the ability and the desire can pursue higher education. Because, as Bernie has noted in the past, the high school diploma of say 1946 is a college degree today. And I've been saying that for decades. I'm going to run this audio because odds are you did not get a chance. Maybe you've already seen it or heard it somewhere else online today, but I'll tell you where you didn't see it or hear it. You didn't see it or hear it at Chicken Noodle News. You didn't see it or hear it at MSNBC. You didn't see it or hear it at ABC, CBS, NBC. God knows you didn't hear it at Fox. Because they're too busy waiting for T-Rump to yap. As Les Moonves said a week or so ago, the head of CBS, he said, you know, Donald Trump has been very good for CBS News. Because he's a content machine. He's an outrage machine. He's a carnival clown. With ready-made outrages. So do, let's, I mean, this isn't a terribly long clip, but it is damned well worth the effort to listen to and the time that goes into it. Again, this is the unbroadcasted by the for-profit media, mainstream media, whatever you want to call them, summation to Bernie Sanders' speech in Seattle before more than 30,000 people. By the way, tell me next time you hear about Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton getting 30,000 people to show up for one of her rallies. Because, I mean, I've been kind of keeping track. They don't come out for her like they come out for Bernie. Bernie has tapped into a deep-seated desire inside the American electorate. And you know what? To a certain extent, it is that same... This isn't anything new. It is the same deep-seated desire that was answering the fears of a struggling America when a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt stepped in to try to right wrongs. This millennial generation is not nearly so different from the same generation that put FDR in the White House.
And that is how change always takes place. It takes place when people look around them and say the status quo is not acceptable. Racism is not acceptable. Sexism is not acceptable. Homophobia is not acceptable. And today, I believe that we are at that moment in our history where the status quo simply is not acceptable. And if you go beyond the corporate media and their sense of reality, and you look around and you say, no, why should we have more income and wealth inequality than any other major country on earth? Not acceptable. Why should we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any nation on earth? Not acceptable. Why should people in America have to work two or three jobs to bring in enough income and health care? Not acceptable. Why are billionaires able to buy elections? Not acceptable. Why are we the only major country not to guarantee health care and pay family and medical leave to all of our people? Not acceptable. What this campaign is about is redefining who we are as a people. What this campaign is about is rejecting establishment politics, establishment economics. What this campaign is the understanding that if millions of people, many of whom have given up on the political process, working people who are disgusted with what goes on in Washington, young people who have never voted in their lives, if we come together and we do not allow the Trumps and others of the world to divide us up, if we demand that we have a government that represents all of us and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors, there is nothing that we cannot accomplish. That's what this campaign is about. And that is what the political revolution is about. It is telling, it is about telling the billionaire class and their super PACs and Wall Street and corporate America and the corporate media that they cannot have it all.
Sound familiar?
Next Saturday at 9 o'clock. It looks like you already know about the caucuses. You know, the big money interests, quite truly, do not want people to participate in the political process. They understand that if you working people don't vote, and young people don't vote, the big money interest will always win. Well, next Saturday, let's give them a miserable day. Let us have a record-breaking turnout here in Washington. And if we do, we're going to win, and Washington will help make the political revolution. Thank you all very much.
Well, I'm damn sure inspired. I don't know about y'all, but I am. And you know what? I'm excited about May in West Virginia. Because that's when I get to vote. That's when I get a primary vote. And that's when my primary vote is going to go to Bernie Sanders. And I got a note here from Brother Deacon Asa, who says, Bob, can I play the devil's advocate for a moment? Absolutely. The fact that Bernie can pack the House with those numbers despite coverage from the media indicates that their coverage is ultimately inconsequential. I would submit to you that people are hearing his message regardless. Of course, I'm open to hearing why I'm wrong. I'm not saying that. I don't necessarily think that you're wrong, Asa. Here's where it becomes a problem, though. When we catch the for-profit media doing what we know that they've been doing, for instance, the story that we talked about from the New York Times, where very subtly and over a course of hours, a positive story about Bernie went from being a positive story to being a negative story, because it's been monkeyed with from the highest levels of the New York Times because of pressure put on them by the Clinton camp. Well, you can't say anything nice about him. You've already endorsed her. How dare you? And make no mistake, that's the influence of money. That's money talking. And the bullshit went walking right downstairs and went to work on that story. And when coverage of T-Rump outstrips every other candidate by, 100-1, then what you've got is a fourth estate that is abdicating its essential constitutionally protected mandate. B, the people that are in that rally are mostly people who are tapped into social media. Social media are a very, very strong means of communication. There's no doubt about it. But just as there are people who still don't have cell phones and have only landlines, there are still people who get their news, who get their information, and all of it mostly from the electronic altar in their living room or bedroom. I would submit to you that that probably explains a great deal of Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton's success in the Confederacy. She really didn't have to campaign, did she? Did you notice? Were there 50,000 person rallies for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton in Arkansas or Alabama or Tennessee or Georgia or her largest margin of victory, Mississippi, Stan? Were there? Uh-uh. Bernie's already been to Idaho twice, and Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton doesn't even think Idaho's worth paying attention to. Hasn't set foot in the state. So, the response, I think, Asa, is that the for-profit media are doing everything that they can to tamp down this monumental surge in popularity for Senator Sanders. It's not so much that he's doing okay without it. Imagine what Senator Sanders would be doing if the for-profit media were actually doing their job and giving his campaign as much coverage as Trump's. Trump packs them in too, I guess. It's a different kind of packing, really. But he's bringing a lot of people out. And yet he's the one who gets the coverage, while the person who's actually talking, you know, he's got a slogan that says, Make America Great Again. Bernie has a plan that will make America greater than it has ever been. How did the Clinton campaign miss that? It's not about making America great again. It's about making us greater than we have ever been. Because throughout history, all of the things that have resembled greatness in this country have been attenuated and have been compartmentalized. In the Victorian Gilded Age, America was undoubtedly great. If you were a robber baron, if you were an immigrant working a 96-hour work week, however, America wasn't so great. If you were a worker who lost a limb in an industrial accident and there was no insurance and there was no workers' compensation and you were unable to be unable to earn a wage to support your family for the rest of your natural born days, and your family was cast in immediately into dire poverty, America wasn't so great. But by God, if you were a Vanderbilt or a Walker or a Bush or a Rockefeller, America was great. In the days of the continental expansion westward, America was great if you were a land speculator. You could rake in tons of money that way. America might even have been great if you were one of the white folks who were willing to go out there and go to war with the people who'd been living on that land for a few millennia and seize it and steal it from them and set up your own housekeeping and your own farming. America may have been great for you. You can argue that America was great all the way up to 1865, but only for white folks. And for the most part, only for white male folks. And for a big chunk of that time, only for white male folks who owned property, real estate. But America was great for them. That frontier era I mentioned? If you look through family histories, you'll find men out there who live into their 80s and they had three or four wives along the way. It's not because they were trying to set up some sort of frontier caliphate and had multiple wives or were Mormons. It's because the women died and died. And died and died. Usually in their 40s. So America wasn't so great for them. And women didn't even get the vote until the second decade of the 20th century. So again, not so much greatness. even after 1865 and after the 13th Amendment. After the insurrection and insurgency that imposed Jim Crow on the South. Not so great to be a person of color in America. And all of this goes back to that wonder, that tremendous poem, Let America Be America Again. Langston Hughes. Because it never was to me, he writes. And so we have finally reached a point in this country where I would say a majority of us have reached the conclusion that we do have potential in this country for something that we vaguely refer to as greatness. But we have also realized that in order to achieve anything resembling that, we're going to have to finally do it all together. And we're going to have to do it with an eye toward opening up that potential for everyone. Right? And that's what Bernie's talking about. Making America greater than it has ever been. And so rather than just jumping out there with a whole busload of morons, we got them. And obviously our first nominee of the evening is a general nomination of the for-profit media. Hey, boss, what do you say we do a story on the Sanders phenomenon?
Shop! I'm not paid to do that. Yeah, give me a
story of go find me a little girl eating an ice cream cone and petting a squirrel while wearing a Trump hat. Yeah. Yeah. You get the idea. But in my father's house are many more ends. We'll get to them. Ooh, yeah, we're going to get to them. I got us one, hang on. There he is. Yeah, I got us one right out of the break. Mm-hmm. I do. I really, really do. You're listening to independent, listener-supported conversation radio. Pretty much unlike anything else out there. And, of course, you're welcome to participate. I got some morons I want to jump into, so maybe hold your calls for a few minutes. But we'll end the filibobster right here and take a break. We try to raise $200 every evening. And at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on this, the 21st day of March 2016, the first hour of the program, we are at zero, nil, nihil, niente, zed, zip, nada. Let's hope it doesn't stay that way. I'm Bob Kincaid.
These days, a lot of people think you've got to be a billionaire to buy a candidate. At Congressman's Warehouse, we believe that millionaires deserve quality candidates too. We respect your dark money, no matter what denomination it comes in. At Congressman's Warehouse, you get to design your own candidate. Limited government, tax and spend, preemptive strike, lead from behind, gun control, open carry. All the latest styles at prices you can afford. Choose from climate change deniers, Second Amendment fetishists, Wall Street deregulators, draft-dodging warmongers, transvaginal ultrasoundists, and this week only, save on cisgendered restroom traditionalists. At Congressman's Warehouse, we don't waste your money on image consultants and handlers. We tailor your dyed-in-the-wool candidates directly to your agenda and pocketbook. You're going to like the way they vote. I guarantee it.
I'm searching for the spirit of the great heart.
6 minutes past the hour. Seemed appropriate. Originally a song by Johnny Clegg, covered by Jimmy Buffett. Great Heart is the title. And, of course, I think Bernie's got that kind of great heart. Yeah. Okay, let's just go over to the phones for a minute, and then we'll get into the more ends. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, am I on the air?
You yes, are. I am. You are.
This is Harry from Baltimore.
Harry, what's up?
Good. I won't keep you long. I'm sure there are plenty of other people who want to get on. I guess several things I wanted to just say briefly. First of all, this is not something that I have a lot of credibility about, but I hope that everyone will consider contributing tonight to your program. I'm at the point where if I could sell my socks and make some money from them, I would send that money to you. But
bless your heart, Harry. Thank you.
That's about all I have to offer at the moment, as unfortunately because of my work situation. But I wish I did have something that I could sell easily and send you the money for, because you're for.
Don't worry about it. We'll hang in and hang on.
And I realize, of course, that many of your listeners, you know, also are feeling, you know, pressure, economic pressures because of what I, you know, underneath believe really is just a complete, you know, takeover of the economy by the 1% and 30 or 40 years of government regulations that have changed to in favor of the 1% and therefore allowed them even more easily to take away money from the rest of the population. So although I certainly, you know, I'm not excusing myself on my work situation, but I do believe that there are very strong structural changes out there that have been happening sometimes silently since the 1970s. And I think we're all paying for it now. And I am just very, well, I'm not only sad about it, but I'm furious because it was all happening. And yet, you know, not a lot of people were talking about it. The main thing I wanted to say is you were at the beginning of the program, you were talking about your listeners from other countries and also about expatriates in other countries who would not want to come back to the U.S. because where they're living now is actually better than.
Well, would not, more importantly, Harry, could not.
When you say could not, you mean
couldn't afford to
psychologically? Couldn't afford to.
To a certain extent, it happens within the United States. I mean, everybody knows that I love the place where I grew up, but I couldn't move to Alabama. I'd lose my health care.
Oh, right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Okay. Well, no, I agree with that. What I wanted to say was that, you know, even for, certainly for people who, you know, are living in other countries, they know about the social programs that we don't have and the things that, in a sense, prevent them from going bankrupt, you know, because of a medical illness or because of other problems or other kinds of debts and also schooling. And, you know, I think I may have told you once that back in January, the new Michael Moore film, it's called Where to Invade Next,
right,
came to Baltimore. And it came really, I'm sorry to say, for only about 2 weeks. It was at the Main Art Theater and it disappeared, frankly, I suspect, because not many people went to see it. I saw it on a weekday because I was in the area near this theater for a medical appointment, and I went to see the first show of the day, and there were about 10 people. And the film had just come in, been released in Baltimore, though it had been released in other cities back in December. And among the 10 people were these two retired female school teachers who now live in Baltimore County, which is basically the suburbs where people flee to from Baltimore City. And we had a small chat. This is before the film mostly. And they said, you know, none of our friends wanted to come. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because they don't really believe anything, you know, can change. And they don't really necessarily want anything to change. And they said, but we really, you know, we feel differently and we're curious and we want to see what Michael Moore had to say. Now, I don't know if anybody has seen the film, and I don't want to in any way ruin it for it, but what Michael Moore basically does, and I'm trying not to give away any of the most the great moments of the film, and it really is.
Yeah, no spoilers. No spoilers.
Right. But I've got to tell you, I've seen all of Michael Moore's films, not necessarily when they came to theater, but, you know, over time, particularly on DVD, I've seen all of his films, and I have to say that this is, if not among the best, perhaps the best film he's ever made. And I say that because what he really does, and that he did this in different ways, briefly in other films like Sicko, which was his 2007 film about the healthcare system, where he took this group of Americans who all had, you know, terrible healthcare problems, and were some of whom had gone into bankruptcy, et cetera, and he was trying to find them a place either in America or else even elsewhere, including Guantanamo, where they could get better health care. And in fact, he also goes to France in that film and talks to people, expatriates living in France, who talk about all the great social programs, not just health care, but also care for that's given by the government to new mothers, in terms of, and again, not just in terms of passive things like, you know, maternal leave, but also there are people, basically France gives you people who come in to help mothers with things like laundry, et cetera. I mean, it's just, it's amazing what some of these countries, you know, offer in terms of social programs. But in this film, Where to Invade Next, he doesn't go to, although he does, but, you know, go to the usual suspects, I suppose you'd say, like, you know, France, Germany, and Norway, you know, Scandinavian countries. But he goes to other places. For example, I'm not spoiling this. He goes to Slovenia, where it turns out where education, this is Slovenia, not a huge country, but education, you know, higher education there is free. And he interviews several American students who all said that they felt or realized that they could not afford college in the United States. And then they heard about Slovenia. And the National University of Slovenia teaches a large number of its courses in English. So this is where they're going to college, even though these are, you know, people from, you know, Main Street, you know, ordinary, you know, Ville, USA. And here they are in Slovenia because they just felt that, you know, it was too expensive, or they didn't have the money, or they just couldn't get the money to go to, you know, four-year college in the United States. And then, you know, there, and there's some other things that are just amazing. You know, the public health minister of a country talking about how in that country, basically, there are no drug arrests because drug use and or substance abuse and addiction are considered medical problems, and they don't arrest anybody for that. You know, they treat people, but nothing criminal about it, never. And of course, in all these countries, you know, that he goes to, if I recall correctly, yeah, all of them pretty much, you know, of course, have national, well, they would have national health care, since we're one of the few nations in the entire planet that doesn't have national health care, and probably the only developed country. So I would urge people, if they want to get a taste, and if they happen to, and, you know, and Michael Moore has a certain kind of comical, ironic style, but if you, you know, like Michael Moore, or just, you know, want to see a film where someone in kind of a, you know, trying to be humorous but also quite serious, goes abroad to find social program policies that other countries have that are just so far superior to what's going on in this country, I would urge people to go to see the movie. And I have to tell you, and I, not only were the two retired school teachers that they have tears in their eyes at the end of the film, but I myself was crying, because the movie is more than his prior films, really just points out so clearly what people in other countries have, you know, and the kinds of cultural attitudes, of social policy, philosophy, and programs that are so much more humane, you know, and I'm not just talking about one kind of thing, you know, I mean, certain countries he goes to for the prison, one he goes to for the education system, actually two countries, one he goes to for what happened when they had a revolution and then women's rights were written into the new constitution, even though this was actually a Muslim-dominated country. And just, you know, things that even I wasn't aware of that were had gone on or going on abroad. And as I said, I was almost weeping when I left the theater because it just makes the what we are missing here, or once were, or maybe we once had a little bit of, but then decided or were, you know, somehow turned against it, that other countries then developed to a far greater degree. For example, and I'll just say one thing, he goes to Italy where they have all sorts of vacation time and sick leave, et cetera. And he interviews two working, basically working class, a couple. One is a policeman, the other works in a factory. And they have all sorts of vacation. I mean, they went to Boston on vacation and they, you know, he shows photos of them and, you know, they went to Caribbean, et cetera. And, you know, and then he interviewed the CEOs of a few countries, and Italy apparently, you know, doesn't believe in, you know, overtime. People, you know, they urge people to leave as soon as, you know, the workday is over. I mean, it's, you know, and maybe, of course, he was, you know, perhaps you could say he was cherry picking a little.
Yeah, but not me.
But the fact is that you see these people and the, you know, and I don't think these are, you know, people that he, you know, spent years researching to find. A lot of these people are just ordinary people. And, you know, and you hear these, and in fact, when he tells the Italian couple that by law there is, you know, no real, in a sense, legal right for anyone to have a vacation in the United States, their mouths drop open, you know. They say, what do you mean? What? How could that be? I mean, it is just, and, you know, this is all within a, you know, a film of less than 2 hours. And
yeah.
It's
100 minutes or so, yeah.
Yeah, it's a travel, and, you know, it's sort of a travelogue, but it's a travelogue of better social programs and policies, all of which make those societies seem
well, and there's a
so much more humane.
And there's a value. There's a value to it, Harry, because again, we're in a bubble here. You know, this is a community of people who know that there's a world out there. There's a lot of people in the United States who don't. And,
yes, and that's
who have been taught, Harry, not to see things and want better, but to see someone else doing better and want to drag them down to their level.
I mean, agree. And to me, you see, that is the kind of really sinister propaganda or brainwashing that we, unfortunately, I believe that has happened in the United States, particularly in the last 40, 50, 60 years. I mean, I really believe that. I have no other explanation except a kind of propaganda assault. You know, the Powell memorandum was part of that, but also other things, you know, and Fox News and television. You know, I've said before on this program, I don't watch TV anymore, but last night someone else in my house here was watching local news. And do you know that they were talking about the delegate count in, I forget which primary? And just as you said, I've always said, Bob, this is a local news station. When they talked about the totals of delegates, right away, it was clear they had added in Hillary's superdelegates. And I turned to the person who was watching. I said, that's wrong. They're adding, you know, they're giving Hillary an extra 500 delegates or so and making, you know, it look like she's so much farther ahead when she's only, you know, when in fact there's only about, I guess, 300 delegates right
well,
now.
Well, but since, the, I mean, there's that, but there's also the fact, are you aware of this letter that's gone out from a bunch of Democratic senators?
I'm sorry.
A bunch of Democratic senators have signed onto a letter that basically says, damn it, Bernie, quit this. You're going to spoil Hillary's fun.
Oh, no. Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. That must have come out today. I'm sorry.
Nah, it's in the last few days.
Okay.
You know,
there's something. I'm sorry.
No, they you know, quit. I mean, it was everything yeah. but a witch on a broom in the sky, skywriting surrender, Bernie.
Oh, jeez. See, I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, you know, and I really try to stick with things that I can empirically, you know, document or whatever. But I'm sorry, there's something very, you know, to me, propaganda-ish about the way in which people seem to think that, you know, there's nothing better, or that the system is working the way it should be, and that, you know, they, you know, I don't know. It just, there's something very in the culture that has just become so self-defeating and self-destructive that I am, you know, I just now think of it as propaganda, you know, successful propaganda. And it troubles me deeply. And I've never been a person, you know, who's talked a lot about, you know, propaganda or conspiracies or, you know, or whatever. But I just can't explain it any other way. And as I said, seeing a few minutes on TV, that just really infuriated me, because, you know, and as I said, it was a local network station, but still local news. And they never said anything about whether Hillary's totals were just, you know, delegates or superdelegates. I mean, they just put out, you know, a graph or whatever, a table, and there it was. And I think that's horrifying, really. I mean, because, of course, you know, every time it seems as if Hillary is so much more inevitable, then, of course, you know, you demoralize other people or you discourage them. Or that letter you mentioned, which I haven't seen, but I believe you. I mean, what are they doing, you know, except they're the elites? You know, I mean, this is the thing. I think it's all about the elites, and they just don't want to give up any of what they have, even the Democratic Party elites. You know, I once knew someone who was a DNC operative, and I can tell you, you know, they didn't act all that different from the Republican National Committee operatives. I mean, they all want to maintain, you know, their power, particularly, you know, in a place like D.C., power and position, you know, is almost everything. And so people who were, you know, longtime DNC, National Democratic Party operatives, you know, they're to uproot them or to, you know, ask them to basically give up some of their or all of their influence. As you said, it's going to take more, you know. I mean, it's going to take really hard. I don't know what, you know, some sort of real social, you know, turmoil and churning and something and a change in, you know, and people doing not just, you know, doing the same old thing day after day, but, you know, I can only think of mass protests. And, you know, going out on the street and, you know, local level organizing to get, you know, all these people out of Congress. And I don't know what else to say except that, you know, and so to me, Bernie is really the inevitable, frankly, candidate because of the social conditions in this country. He's the only one speaking to how bad they really are. So to me, yeah, I just thought of it, but yeah, to me, he's the inevitable person who should be not only the candidate, Democratic nominee, but also the president, because nobody else seems to want to do anything even remotely like what he is talking about. And I'll stop because I know you probably want to say something.
You know, because of our correspondence, that I've been deeply immersed in this book about Burr and Hamilton.
Yes.
Incidentally, it is worth noting, and I've said this before, Harry, that this, you know, this country does not have some golden mist-covered past in which we campaigned politely.
Absolutely not. No, you're right.
Along about 1799. Alexander Hamilton, who, because he got killed in a duel by Aaron Burr, gets to be the good guy in history. Poor Alexander Hamilton. Was a backbiting snake.
Yeah.
For whatever good he did, he was a vicious personality. And if I recall correctly, as early as 1799, he was spreading rumors that Aaron Burr had murdered his wife, one of her children, and his own sister, and was engaged in a sexual relationship with his teenage daughter.
Okay. Yeah, I remember reading vaguely about that somewhere.
So, you know, this is, it's nothing new. Here's the difference. We have a for-profit media structure now that feeds on that. It's the grease that makes the wheels turn, and it's the fuel that fires the engine. And you know, something is very, very ugly. Something very ugly is afoot in this country. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, back just a couple of days ago, there was a T-Rump rally in Tucson.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, what happened in North Carolina played out all over again.
Yes.
Because a man, once again, was being escorted out, and a Trump follower not only sucker punched him in the face, but once he was on the ground, was allowed to kick him for a while.
Yes, I had heard vaguely about that, and I know he was totally, you know, just vicious, I don't know what is next, but it doesn't bode well, to say the least. I've told you in the past, you know, growing up around New York City as a child, you know, I remember Donald Trump when he was really just sort of a younger brat and, you know, was really just a kind of a controversial alleged businessman who would show up on rude programs like the Howard Stern radio show and all that, you know, but he's come much worse, you know, than I even remember him reading about him in the New York Times or other, you know, or on hearing about him on the radio. I mean, he always was, you know, a really bratish kind of, you know, bully, but he's at this point, he's almost out of control. I mean, he is out of control. I just think I wonder if this, you know, his unexpected successes, frankly, have just really, you know, turned him delusional, you know, where he really thinks that he, you know, can do whatever he wants. I mean, you know, it almost approaches, you know, a personality disorder or some sort of, you know, power psychosis. I say that seriously, you know, I just watching him and what he said and saying what he cares about, what he doesn't, you know, it's truly astounding. And yes, and of course you would say also the media coverage, right? He's gotten all this free media coverage because he is also entertainment, as people have pointed out, you know. He's good for ratings, and you mentioned CBS, I guess, and Les Moonves.
Because Les Moonves really did say
he's been very
good for us.
Yes, no, I remember reading that. Yeah, no, I meant that seriously. Yeah, no, and you know, I also saw a graph recently of media coverage. It was basically two tables: one of bought media coverage and other of quote earned media coverage, meaning free media coverage that was given
news,
for whatever reason.
News, meaning news.
I'm sorry?
Earned media coverage, meaning news, being newsworthy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the amount that Trump has invested versus the amount that he, quote, earned it's unbelievably striking. I mean,
oh, it's a billion to one,
ratio.
Isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it's a huge ratio.
I mean, only in the last day or so did Joke Toad over at Meet the Prestitutes declare that T-Rump would no longer be able to just phone in his blather. That he would actually have to come and sit down across from the piercing gaze of Joke Toad.
Chuck Todd actually decreed that?
Yes.
Amazing, actually, even
right.
With the barn
no longer in flames, but rather just a smoldering heap of ashes, and and where the barn door once stood, a couple of 4x stumps. He took the last little charred bits with the metal on it and swung that barn door shut. With the T-Rump horse long gone. Yeah. Well, let me ask you one
analogy.
Thing. While I've got you, because I mean we all know what my upbringing was. Your thoughts, because you've told us you're Jewish. You were raised in that tradition.
Yes. Yeah.
Your thoughts on Bernie deciding just not to go to the AIPAC meeting at all.
Well, of course, I'm, not a, I consider myself sort of, actually kind of like Bernie, kind of a secular Jew, and also having lived in Washington and having known about the whole sort of Jewish, I don't want to call them, what can I call them, club or whatever. No, I think that was a very courageous move on his part. And the fact is that AIPAC has been this ridiculously, extraordinarily powerful lobby in Washington, not just among neocons, a lot of whom in the beginning were Jewish and came out of Jewish journals like Commentary, but and Public Interest. But also you have a lot of Jews in Washington, all across the country, but certainly, let's say, like in Washington temples, who otherwise might not, might have mixed feelings about what Israel as a state is doing. But the fact is that AIPAC is so powerful, so strong, has been, for I think for the whole time that I lived in D.C., which was 24 years, that they are just, nobody can, in a sense, it got to a point where it seemed like nobody could resist them. So I guess, frankly, I have to say, I think that it's an incredibly courageous thing for him to do, to basically put AIPAC in its place, which is that it's not Israel, it's not the Jewish people, it's just a damn lobby, basically, that has a lot of money that has collected over the years. And they have used that money and, the lobbyists that they hire or contract to basically just dominate, in a sense, anything having to do with Israel or the Jewish people.
And to absolutely muzzle dissent.
Absolutely. Yes. I suppose I should have made that more emphatic. Yes. No, I never, believe me, I would have crossed to the other side of the street if I had seen someone whom I knew worked for AIPAC, because their way was the only way in D.C. for Jews. And it was despicable. And, a lot of it would trickle down, frankly, even into so-called Reform temples, one of which I belonged to for a while. And you just had this sense that the AIPAC just would assert itself as the, Jewish Israel, whatever lobby. And they claimed always to represent, the Jewish interests. And I'm sorry, it's just not true.
They represent Israeli interests.
Well, they represent a small, club, a cabal. I mean, a small group or a certain political ideological group. And then act as if they represent all Jews in the United States and that they are basically, in direct communication, maybe by mind meld with, all of the leaders of Israel. And
I ask you, Harry,
it's
because
delusion. I mean,
I ask you for a specific reason, because while Bernie just took a pass, of course, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton
went.
Oh, I knew she would.
And,
oh, yeah,
and,
she had to.
But here's, there's something happening inside her campaign. And it's kind of bizarre.
Right.
Because
well, I didn't know about it.
We listened, you know, we saw during the pageants how she would talk about, you know, hers was going to be the third Obama term. And how dare that nasty Bernie say anything bad about Barack Obama? But she stood up on the stage at AIPAC and put the shiv right between his ribs today.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Now I hope this doesn't come across as Hillary bashing, but I'm simply I'm simply reporting facts. She got up on the stage.
Wow.
She got up on the stage at AIPAC today and said the following. Now let's remember as a setup. When the Republican House invited Bibi Netanyahu, the psychopathic warmonger, that's my opinion,
exactly.
Of course.
No, not right.
Fascist psychopathic warmonger.
Certainly delusional, whatever. Anyway,
They invited. So Barack Obama said, "Nah, you know, I don't think I want to have him over for coffee after he goes and hangs out with that bunch." So,
well, that's partly because, frankly, he was so they disrespected Barack Obama so much by the way they did that.
Well, they were
even, you know, regardless of, you know, what you think of Bibi Netanyahu, but the whole thing was really despicable in terms of even just sort of Washington custom and you know.
So here's Hillary at AIPAC today, Harry.
Yeah.
One of the first things I'll do in office is invite the Israeli Prime Minister to visit the White House. And I will send a delegation from the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs to Israel for early consultations. Let's also expand our collaboration beyond security. Together, we can build an even more vibrant culture of innovation that tightens the links between Silicon Valley and Israeli tech companies and entrepreneurs.
Well, see, that's the whole, in a sense, I mean, that's like the nub of what particularly Israel wants is the alliance. And I've got to say that, I think something, this is my theory, okay? And boy, people are going to, some Jewish people in your audience are going to think I'm nuts. But my theory about this is that, for example, after 9/11, you know, I worked part-time after, few years after 9/11 at a Jewish community center, and they had already they had, you know, lots of security, and they'd already hired a former Israeli army captain as head of security. And it was just, you had this feeling that they were, you know, what I'm trying to say is Israel in a strange way became very macho and kind of this kind of muscular Judaism. And I don't think it happened right away after, you know, Israel was founded, but somehow in the years after that, it grew and grew and grew. And I say this, I'll tell you why, because I once thought about moving to Israel about 10 years ago because, you know, I would be granted automatic citizenship there. But I was warned against it. And one of the main reasons I was warned against it was because Israel had become so macho. And, you know, I don't necessarily mind, you know, I mean, well, I do mind, you know, men being overly macho, but I didn't feel that I was in any particular danger. But I was told, no, it's really, you know, it's just kind of become this muscular, macho, militaristic society. You don't want to go there. And I think that this just gets into psychological things, but I think that the trauma of the Holocaust, that there's still this, in a sense, post-traumatic stress that is Israeli society is under. And there's a portion of that society that still feels this need to defend themselves with everything they can possibly get, including nuclear weapons, etc., because they feel that that's the only way that they can protect themselves. I'm talking about, you know, this part of this would be unconscious, but that this is the only way they can protect themselves from future Holocausts. So I say this in a way sympathetically, because I think there is this kind of trauma in Israel, of in Israeli society, that they are still traumatized by the Holocaust. And you do have either people who went, you know, from Europe directly to Israel, or their descendants living there now. And I don't think that, I think this needs some sort of, you know, I don't know. I think Israel needs to have a national discussion with itself about whether it is, you know, reliving the traumas that some of its current or former residents, you know, experienced in
whether it is in turn acting, you know, I mean, you know what acting out behavior is. Within psychology.
Yeah, although I guess I'm trying to give them, I'm trying to give them benefit of doubt and talk about it as some sort of post-traumatic stress.
But I mean, it's not unusual to see acting out behavior from someone who has been traumatized.
Okay, well, I'm not sure what you mean by acting out. I mean,
I guess I'm more familiar with it from a child psychology standpoint.
Okay.
But if you've got a child who's been abused, they will then, in turn, be abusive.
Ah, okay.
And
well,
I think to a certain extent that explains their behavior toward the Palestinians.
Absolutely. But yeah, I guess I would say that. Yeah, okay.
But the idea that Hillary would stand up on a stage and obliquely criticize President Obama, who had very good reasons for not sitting down and having a little chat with Bibi.
Oh, yeah.
I find repulsive, but it gets even worse. It gets kind of worse. Harry, you know what the BDS movement is.
Yes, I do.
Boycott, divest,
and sanctions. In fact, it's pretty lively here in Baltimore.
Well, I'm a supporter of the BDS movement.
Yeah.
I think it was the only way that we brought any degree of change to South Africa, mm-hmm. and I see Israel in the same light as we once saw South Africa, and so on college campuses, and I think this is sort of it may be a stretch to say this, but I think this is probably a bit of a dig at Bernie's supporters too. Because I wouldn't be surprised to find out that there's a strong BDS contingent among the college students who support Senator Sanders. Because you cannot look at the way the Palestinians are treated and just go, yeah, well, whatever they want to do is fine by me.
That's why I'm so horrified at what the state of Israel has done. I
mentioned that because for some reason or another, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton felt it incumbent upon her. Maybe somebody at AIPAC told her that she needed to say this. I don't know.
I would bet, yes.
But she got to a portion of her speech where she said this. Many of the young people here today, and I guess she's talking about the young people at the AIPAC meeting. I didn't know they had a kids table there. many of the young people.
No, they bus in college students just like they do for lots of.
Okay. Many of the young people here today are on the front lines of the battle to oppose the, and she you know, I think word choice matters. You're a longtime practitioner of the art of knowing words, as am I.
Well, I defer to you.
Many of the young people here today are on the front lines of the battle to oppose the alarming boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS. Alarming? You know what I find alarming, Harry? American financed munitions that are used to hellfire missile a Palestinian infant in its crib. I find that alarming. I think it's okay to use that participle in that context. I don't think it's alarming for people to act upon their consciences. That's all the BDS movement is. It's not alarming.
That's right.
It is a movement of conscience. But to Hillary, it's alarming.
And she continues and says, well, particularly at a time when anti-Semitism is on the rise across the world, especially in Europe, we must repudiate all efforts to malign, isolate, and undermine Israel and the Jewish people. See, she did that thing. That thing where, I mean, you, Harry, and all the many Jewish people who are members of the Horn Family Community Congregation, congratulations, Hillary says you're Israel.
No, no. See, that's the thing. No, see, I'm totally opposed to what Israel has been doing. And also, and I think Bibi Netanyahu, as you called him a psychopath, you know, I think he has serious problems. And one of which may be that he's still, I think, wounded from the death of his nephew, you know.
His brother at Entebbe, wasn't
right.
it?
Yeah, I think it was his nephew. Was
I thought
brother?
It was his brother.
Was junior brother. Hmm. Okay, I could be wrong. I always get them mixed up. Yeah, at Entebbe. Yeah, I think he still probably hasn't successfully mourned that or gotten, you know,
But the thing is, I mean, it is such a manifest untruth to say that the BDS movement is, you know, equals sign maligning, isolating, and undermining Israel. The BDS movement is nothing more and nothing less than the time-honored tradition of using economic pressure to try to achieve social improvement.
Well,
Am I outside the ballpark here?
Oh, no, no, you're right. No, you're right on point, spot on. But I was going to say, I think, though, the reason why Hillary may have wanted to bring this up at this AIPAC conference, and I said with probably buses loads of college students bused in, is that, you know, as you probably know, and may have read about it at times, you know, on university campuses, the BDS issue has become very tense, and also it's become very tense at professional meetings of academics, such as the American Historical Association and other, particularly social science fields. And, you know, there have been motions like to either, you know, support or not support BDS movements at these academic conventions. And then there have been, you know, sort of heated, you know, arguments or whatever, or disputes among, you know, college students. Both pro-BDS, you know, and anti-BDS, and a lot of them are, of course, Jewish. So I think that's part of it, that there are these people who are so offended by the BDS movement because it seems to be, you know, maligning and attacking Israel and all that. But yes, I agree. But I think in truth, what you're saying is absolutely correct. But the problem is you still have this turmoil going on, I think, on some university and college campuses. And I think that's what she was maybe.
Well, she wasn't done. And this is why I think there was a subtle dig at Bernie involved. She says,
go ahead.
To all the college students who may have encountered this on campus, I hope you stay strong. Keep speaking out. Don't let anyone silence you, bully you, or try to shut down debate, especially in places of learning like colleges and universities. Well, isn't what she's saying that she wants to shut down debate? She wants to shut down the BDS movement? Didn't she just say that it's an alarming thing to her?
Yes. Look, I will say this, and again, this is... Some people can hate me for saying this, but I, you know, among Jewish or Jewish even intellectuals, academics, and of course, most prominent of this, I suppose, would be Noam Chomsky. But among people who think and are willing, you know, not to just blindly, you know, say, oh yeah, I'm with Israel because I'm Jewish. The fact is, you know, and these people have not necessarily been able to speak out because there's so much tension about this. In fact, I once read an article for the New York Times about a year ago talking about how the issue of what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, you know, New York having lots and lots of Jews, you know, more Jews than any other city. Apparently that has caused problems in like normal social life among middle class Jews and, you know, their friends. and people are more afraid to talk about it because the division is there. And the fact is that there are many very conscientious Jewish people who just are just appalled at what is being done to the Palestinians. And yes, it may be the kind of, well, I wouldn't call it acting out. I call it, you know, a cycle, continuing cycle of abuse, you know, where, yes, one generation is abused and then they go on to abuse the next generation. And that, I think, is, that's why I mentioned this thing about, you know, that in a way I wish kind of the state of Israel could be psychoanalyzed, because I think a lot of this, some of it's unconscious and some of this I think is a result of trauma or the cycle of abuse over generations. And I am informed that in fact this kind of trauma and abuse can be, you know, can in a sense be transmitted from generation to generation.
Well, so, this strikes me as just an absolutely textbook case of pandering.
Of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, but,
in a way, you know, this is, I don't know enough about AIPAC to, you know, talk as an expert about them, but they are kind of, I mean, they've been, you know, they're known as kind of a strong arm.
They're enforcers.
Absolutely. So,
because the part that made my skin crawl, Harry, as if the rest of this didn't, the part of this that made my skin crawl was when she got to the part, where she said, I challenge nothing. I take away nothing from the suffering of the Israeli people. Okay, I want to be 100% clear about that.
I would never have thought of that, Bob. I don't think that I would ever.
But she says, I have sat in Israeli hospital rooms, holding the hands of men and women whose bodies and lives were torn apart by terrorist bombs. I've listened to doctors describe the shrapnel left in a leg, an arm, or even a head.
Yeah.
This is what is known in American politics as a case of waving the bloody shirt. That's why I feel so strongly that America can't ever be neutral when it comes to Israel's security or survival. In other words, we're going to be on Israel's side. Fuck the Palestinians, right? But this is the part where I went screaming.
All right.
We can't be neutral when rockets rain down on residential neighborhoods, when civilians are stabbed in the street, when suicide bombers target the innocent. Some things aren't negotiable.
Well, that's right out of the AIPAC playbook, and I got to say that, you see, I've also heard that, frankly, from people I know who are Jewish. Both in D.C. and actually here in Mount Baltimore City, Baltimore County, where a lot of the Jews fled after the 68 riots. But you have people who basically feel that this, in a way, you know, a lot of this Israel's behavior is, quote, justified because of, oh, yes, all those bombs coming over from Palestinian, you know, from Hamas or whatever, or, you know, Hezbollah, or, you know, from Palestinian, or the way that they're hiding, you know, weapons in, you know, public, I don't know, places in the Palestinian area. And these people just, that's the argument, which is that it's one-sided and that, you know, yes, Israel, so, you know, Israeli, innocent Israeli people are being killed and maimed or whatever, but there's no discussion of the fact that, you know, it's, I don't want to say there's an equivalence, but no, I mean, look, there's been lots of violence against Palestinians, you know, really unnecessary, you know, unprovoked. I mean, all kinds, you know, hospitals, whatever. I mean, it's just, the question is, you know, if it's a cycle of violence, how can you just say that one side, you know, is right and one side is wrong? I mean, you know, it's like what Freud said about, you know, the narcissism of minor differences. And in that, he used that to explain often the kinds of ethnic, disputes and violence that went on, you know, all over Europe. And I think this is another example of it. I mean, these two peoples, or, you know, two, whatever you want to call them, are you know, entangled in the cycle of violence, and yet AIPAC and their allies here in America, you know, want to portray it as just a completely one-sided situation. When anybody who researches it, looks into it, you know, reads the news or, you know, or listens to, you know, media that is giving accurate news, and that includes me. I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert, but I certainly know what I have read about, you know, the ridiculous amount of violence.
Well, and there's some agreement out there. Dogman from the chat room just opined, the abused becoming the abuser has been borne out in studies. Only the power elite in Israel don't see it or don't care.
Yeah, no, well, that's what I said. Yeah, no, psychologically, it has definitely been borne out. I think it's pretty much, you know, not quite a truism, but it's pretty much an axiom in psychology, yeah. And the problem, yeah, I think it, in part is the leadership, and particularly Mr. Netanyahu, you know, whom, as I said, had a close relative, you know, killed at Entebbe, you know, the only Israeli killed. And in fact, I remember when I worked at this Jewish community center in D.C., the head of security, who I said was a former Israeli army captain, I mentioned something about the fact that the younger Netanyahu did not come back. And he said to me, ah, yes, a great loss. And I think he meant it, but I also felt like it was kind of a, you know, some sort of patriotic statement, you know, that, in other words, that it was something that was still wounding, you know, like people like him in the military, the thought that, you know, the younger Netanyahu had been, you know, who was the leader of the band that, you know, did the heroics in Entebbe, but that he ended up getting killed. And it's like the wound is still there. And I'm telling you, in Washington,
and they keep
example,
carrying the scab off.
Yeah, and here's the thing. See, places like not only this Jewish Community Center, but this new temple that was built in Washington, downtown Washington, D.C., I once went in there and realized that their head of security was another former Israeli military person. And, and when you go in these places, and at least when I was, the last time I was there, you go in and these guys, you know, they're thinking like, frankly, to me, like they're still in Israel. You know, they're acting like military people. You know, and then they're suspicious of you, you know, even though I'm, you know, I look Jewish. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, I think in anybody's mind that I'm Jewish, but there's this whole kind of siege mentality. And that's even here in D.C. and in, you know, not in all Jewish temples, just the ones, frankly, that I think that are mostly, you know, frankly, sort of related to the establishment. My little temple, actually, I think we once had a private security guard for one of the Jewish holidays, but that person basically stayed out of sight in a way, and it was not considered a big threat. But if you go into some of these very establishment temples, like the one where the Israeli ambassador goes, which is not actually far from where I live, but it's a much bigger temple, and as I said,
Orthodox, I trust.
It's kind of conservative / Orthodox. Yeah, I know people who went there who were both conservative and Orthodox. But yeah, it's pretty serious. And this new temple built downtown, in fact, with money from, believe it or not, Abe Pollin, the owner of the basketball team in Washington, that's considered a very establishment Jewish temple. And again, there, as I said, I once went in there. I actually wanted to get just a tour, look around. And I was confronted right away with this huge, muscular-looking man who, in fact, told me he was from the Israeli military. And he was their chief of security.
Wow.
So, yeah, well, I'm just saying this because I'm saying that some of this started, you know, with the neocons, you know, who a lot of whom, you know, as you may know, first neocon, or were the ones that, I guess, I don't want to say brought it to Washington. A lot of them were Jewish, you know. You had former liberals like Irving Kristol and the editor of Commentary, Norman Podoretz, although he was probably never really liberal. But these were among the first neocons. And then, you know, and in fact, there's kind of a somewhat incestuousness. Elliot Abrams, remember Elliot Abrams from Reagan? I think Reagan or...
Oh, yes. He's...
Yeah.
I think he's one of Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, anointed booger-eating future king of America's foreign policy advisors.
And he got into trouble. Was it over Iran-Contra or something?
The man's been soaked in blood since at least the Reagan administration.
Well, he's Jewish, and when he went to Harvard Law School, he ended up renting a room in the house of a professor of education named Nathan Glazer, who was one of the founding editors of Public Interest, which has always sort of sounded like it's kind of a neutral or even left-leaning journal of public policy, but in fact, it's a neocon creation. And Irving Kristol was another founder of that magazine. And so Elliot Abrams got into that sort of the neocon circle, and he ended up marrying one of the children of one of the older neocons. I forget who it is, but he's married to her. I think it may be maybe Norman Potteritz's stepdaughter or something. Anyway, somebody. So it's some of that, you know, started early on in the 70s with these Jewish intellectuals who suddenly, you know, turned, frankly, who should have been, you know, liberal, but some of them turned right. And, you know, I think a famous line of Irving Kristol, for example, was, a neocon or a conservative Jew is a liberal who's been mugged, you know. And anyway, he ended up leaving New York City because he said that he didn't have any friends there anymore, because the ones who were still liberal Jewish friends, they were upset with him for turning to the right. So he was a professor at NYU, then was given this sort of teaching chair of something at the American Enterprise Institute. And he moved to Washington and got up and became, you know, on the payroll of the American Enterprise Institute, which, as you know, was one of the right-wing think tanks that the right-wing, you know, were certainly eager to plant in Washington, you know, starting after the Powell Memorandum and in the 80s, along with the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute. So that's part of it, too. A lot of these early neocons were Jewish, and they, you know, they and AIPAC got along very well. And, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, another Jewish neocon. I mean, so some of this, is just, I guess I would say, incestuous in a way, you know, ideologically. And that may be part of the reason. I mean, AIPAC always, like, I don't know where all their money came from, but, you know, once they really began to have lots of money,
aren't they at least funded in part by the Israeli government itself?
You know, see, that's the thing. I'm not an expert, but all I know is that they, as I said before, they became this incredibly strong arm influence, you know, in Congress, just strong arming everybody. You know, saying basically, if you're not with Israel and with us, you know, you're against us. And that, you know, that was pretty much true the entire time I lived in Washington, D.C., which is more than 20 years. And I watched AIPAC, you know, certainly grow in its, you know, reported power. And so, as I said, frankly, again, that Bernie Sanders deciding not to go is really, gosh, that to me is just courageous, you know, particularly considering that he is indeed, you know, by blood Jewish. But I think, you know, I don't know how he decided, but I think he just couldn't stomach it, you know. I think he thinks too, you know, he's a person who thinks and observes, and, you know, he's probably, you know, has known for a long time that there's more than one side to this.
Well, I find the...
And, you know, of course, he was a senator for many years. I'm sure he got approached on many occasions by AIPAC and probably knows, you know, them very well and how they operate.
Well, I admire, but, I mean, let's be clear. I admire Bernie for not going.
Oh, no, as I said, I think it's incredibly courageous. Under the circumstances, you know, not only...
I have no doubt that his absence will be used as a smear.
Absolutely. And as I said, the fact, regardless of the primary, just the fact that he's Jewish and wouldn't go, it's just, you know, I'm sure they see that as traitors, just complete treachery. You know, I don't know how, I mean, you know, as I said, what I know about AIPAC, about their you know, black and white thinking. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, Harry, thank you very kindly for a wonderful conversation. I do appreciate it.
Well, I just... I'm going to keep my windows and shades closed tonight. But no, I'm not the only one. There are lots of, you know. I mean,
I don't think you've said anything that wouldn't be generally agreed with. I mean,
well, what I'm saying is that, you know, in the Jewish community in America, okay, there has been, for example, religiously, both in the Reform and Conservative, you know, which are the two below the Orthodox, you know, communities, which everybody knows are really, you know, the most extreme. But even in the Reform and Conservative communities, there has been a religious, ritualistic sort of push to the right. And that has affected everything, lots of things. And for example, even in my what was originally a very Reformed temple, in fact, started during the Vietnam War by anti-Vietnam War protesters. Well, by the time I left Washington, the rabbi there, who actually had been there a long time, but he had become convinced that the only way to really feel good about Judaism, you know, on sort of, because a lot of, you know, people now belong to temples, they want to feel better, or, you know, they want to feel like they belong to a Jewish community. So they join the temple. They want to feel better about, you know, their Jewishness. There's kind of this, you know, the Reform movement originally, you know, was a push away from, you know, older relatives, people, you know, who were more religious. And so the Reform movement was kind of a liberalization of being Jewish in America. But now there's this push going back, in a sense, right wing. And what I was going to say was that my own rabbi, who was a very smart man, and before getting rabbinical training, you know, went to college at, frankly, an Ivy League school, he has been leading these trips of congregants to Israel because he claims somehow that there's something missing unless you now come, go and visit Israel. And that was one of the things, actually, that really began to alienate me from this temple. Because I thought that he was sort of conflating things that shouldn't be conflated.
In other words, Israeli nationalism versus Jewish
identity.
That's
right.
Yeah,
because he, in a sense, was willing to become kind of like he's a really smart and very, very serious person, but
that's like saying I really can't be a baptized Southern Baptist without going until I've had lunch on Sunday at Luby's in Dallas.
Yeah, but it got to the point where every year now he had been organizing these things, and almost, you know, he was almost becoming, I don't want to say a terrible thing, sort of a sarcastic thing to say, but he was becoming like a tour director, you know. You know, you have to.
Well, remember, look, you know, if you organize the tour, you get to go free.
Well, I don't know about that. I think, no, he's a very honest person. I'm not, look, believe me, he's...
Oh, that's not dishonest. It's not dishonest.
Oh, I know, but I don't think that was the deal with him. With him, it was the religious thing. He had just finally decided, even though he was trained as a, you know, Reform rabbi, something, I don't know, changed in him, and he had decided that the Jewish experience, or the experience of being Jewish, could only, in a sense, be fully, you know, comprehended or something by actually traveling to Israel. And so he started these annual trips for congregants, you know, whoever could afford it.
So I guess 1,000 years or 2,000, well, okay, 1,500 years, 1,800 years of Jewish people who weren't able to go to Palestine, did what? They didn't fully appreciate, well, never mind, we'll stay out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, right. I mean, it was, yeah, it was something in his, you know, that he had been thinking about, reading about. Yeah, there was something. I don't know what, I don't even want to try to portray, because I'll probably not do justice to his, you know, internal thinking. I respect the man a great deal for his, you know, personal beliefs. But what I was talking more about, even the Reform movement in Judaism, you know, sort of pushing to the right. And actually, you can see it. In there's a journal, it's called Reform Judaism. It's basically the official magazine of the, you know, Reform, whatever, rabbis and whatever. And you could even see it, and in my temple, at least for a while, everybody who was a member of temple got a free subscription. And in that magazine, you could see people becoming more kind of you know, I don't know how to put it, more right wing in a sense about Judaism, you know, pushing, you know, the rituals, pushing symbols. You know, the Reform movement was meant to be, you know, more of a secular movement, getting away from that.
And that was that was intolerable to the greater right wing. Well, I'm going to roll on so other folks can call in here. But no, it's okay, Harry. It's been a lovely conversation, and I hope you have a great evening.
And thank you so much for listening to me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Harry. Take care.
Bye. Okay. Bye bye.
Calling from somewhere in the greater Balmer area. That's our buddy Harry. Yeah, just to put a little bit of a finish on this. Again, I take nothing away from anyone who has suffered in a terrorist attack. The same way I take nothing away from anyone who has been a victim of violent crime of any sort. Because absent having shared a similar experience, we're all hard-pressed to understand what happens as a result. But what kind of crawls all over me is that everything that she has said is not negotiable for Israelis there at AIPAC can be said about Palestinian people, too. I've listened to doctors describe the shrapnel left in a leg, an arm, or even a head. Well, you know what? There are doctors who could tell you, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton, about what that's like for Palestinian people, too. Has anybody sat down and told her what it's like to have to live in an open air, in the world's largest prison, the open air prison that is effectively the Gaza Strip? Has anybody told her that? Or let's see, we can't be neutral when rockets rain down on residential neighborhoods. Well, we're not only not neutral, we're openly hostile to people who get missiles, guided precision missiles rained down on them, whose children are blown to tiny, tiny molecular pieces in their cribs with weapons that we the people of the United States finance for Israel. We do that. We give them the weapons and they push the buttons. But that doesn't change our responsibility. Let's see, when civilians are stabbed in the street, how about when civilians are murdered and have their homes burned down by Israeli settlers? I guess we're not going to be neutral about that either. We're going to stand on the side of the Israelis. I find it all just disgusting. This is not a situation. You know, this isn't a situation where we should pick a side. We should actually be engaging in leadership and trying to make both sides stop it. Now, granted, the Israelis have by far and away the better weapons. We sold them to them. The Palestinians have to make up their own, and most of their little pissant rockets don't land in neighborhoods. They land harmlessly out in the desert somewhere. The number of Israeli children killed in their cribs by artillery of some sort, close to zero. Much higher number if you're a Palestinian baby trying to sleep peacefully through the night. But make no mistake, Bernie will probably be relentlessly smeared for not showing up and you know, kissing somebody's hairy toe. Dogman points out from the chat room, until the U.S. has an honest convo about the apartheid system in Israel or can even discuss the topic, we have problems. And we are never going to be allowed to have that honest conversation in the United States. Dogman, that's what AIPAC is there to prevent. So let's take another little break. It's about 15 minutes past the hour. We, you know, like I say, I keep saying it, we try to raise $200 every evening in whatever means we can. $5, $10, $15, $20, whatever. And here at 16 minutes past 8 p.m. in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone, we remain at zero. So thank you very kindly for those of you who are willing to help. Again, a little break, and we'll come back. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. Past the hour, and it is more in Monday, and it would not be fair if I didn't promise you, if I didn't provide at least one straight up, no kidding, no really, you know, more in. And I got one. Oh, yes, I do. I do. But of course, you know, the media, they get a nomination for ignoring Bernie. And arguably, yes, we could have saved this till Wednesday. But in light of the fact that you've got people getting beaten up at Trump rallies, in light of the fact that you've got a lot of people finally recognizing what I've been saying for ever so much longer period of time, to wit, that fascism is on the march in this country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's polls out there now saying, do you think Donald Trump's rallies have overtones of fascism? And I can't help but laugh at that when I see them, because I think of people getting polled and go, well, I guess. I mean, I don't. Marveline, what's fascism? I mean, do we in our public school process, and I'm talking about up to grade 12, do we even spend any significant amount of time explaining what fascism is? Because I don't think we do. If you know what fascism is, you either learned it in college, or you went out and learned it on your own. You know, maybe you read Howard Zinn or self-educated, or maybe you had a relative who was in the Second World War. I saw a meme the other day of a World War II soldier, you know, dog face as it were, and it simply said, "In my time, we didn't vote for fascists; we killed them." Mm-hmm. But anyway, it would appear that there are a number of people who, no, they really just don't have a working understanding of what fascism is, and because they don't see Donald Trump as the fascist. Guess who they see? No, you know, don't you? Yeah, of course you do. Because this is from world-renowned bucket o' soup salesman Jim Baker.
As you grew up, mm-hmm. you heard the rhetoric
mm-hmm.
that America is no good.
Yeah, that's what's taught to us. I mean, even with everything that we're taught our history in America, but at the same time, it's from a different source. It's from a different standpoint. And so everything you're taught as you're growing up, you believe that America, you're always apologizing for America. You're always saying that, well, we were the bad guys in the situation. We shouldn't have meddled in that situation. We always stick our hands in where we don't need to be. But that's what we're...
Now, I don't know who this young woman is. But do those moments exist in history? Places where we shouldn't have meddled? Places where we were the bad guy? Places where we shouldn't have stuck our hand in? Because I'm thinking of like the early 1950s in Iran and a democratically elected prime minister named Mossadegh. And I'm also thinking of Chile and a democratically elected president named Salvador Allende and Hillary Clinton's buddy Henry Kissinger saying we can't leave democracy to the people, and having him ousted in a coup. And I'm also thinking of 2009 in Honduras, when there was yet another coup, and Henry Kissinger's pal, Hillary Clinton, basically refused to support the victim of the coup. I believe his name was Zelaya. And, of course, another indigenous human rights activist has been killed in Honduras. The first was last year's Goldman Environmental Prize winner, Berta Caceres. I know, my pronunciation is no good. But she was unequivocal in pointing out that the United States, and in particular Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, had been instrumental in providing support for the coup. And the Clinton campaign can deny it all it wants, but it's a fact. They did not, with the rest of Latin America screaming for the democratically elected leader of Honduras to be returned to power, the United States said, no, 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 we're going to have democratic elections. And thereby made sure that the president was never returned to office, and that Honduras turned into a human rights hellhole. So, yeah, I don't know who you are, ma'am, but there really are times and places in the United States where we haven't gotten it right. And if you want, we could go even further back. How about the Philippines? How about the Philippines when we suppressed the urge for freedom there? Because we did so with real brutality. I guess these little right-wing babies don't want to hear anything but that the United States is a shining city on the hill where everybody shits ice cream and never has heard a discouraging word. But there's plenty of discouraging words.
Taught as American citizens
in this generation. What did Brigitte say to you is the master plan?
To infiltrate our nation, to make our minds, this young generation growing up now are the leaders of our generation and our nation. They're going into these positions and they're the ones now leading our nation. So it's an infiltration from the mind within our nation.
One of the most popular politicians right now is a socialist. And who is his biggest following?
The young people.
The young people of America.
Absolutely.
From the colleges. Maybe you understand a little bit what it felt like to live when Hitler was reigning.
Hitler was reigning? When Hitler reigned? When Hitler ruled? Oh, when Hitler was reigning. No, never mind. I was working up a lyric. Yeah. So, Bernie Sanders running for president and wanting people to be able to go to college and have health care is just like Hitler reigning. Kind of glad we've turned off we've closed the pool for a few days. Sorry, Gerald. It was nice getting to see Gerald Friday evening, by the way. Got to hang out a little bit. It was fun. I think I like Jim Baker better when he was ripping off little old ladies and building water slides.
Maybe you understand a little bit what it felt like to live when Hitler was reigning. And the church had to sit by and keep watching it until millions, tens of millions. They had to build factories to kill people.
Yeah, well, Jim, there's this little problem. The church didn't sit by while Hitler was reigning. The church participated. The church was active. The church jumped in with both feet. It was the rare dissident who spoke up and got dead. But that's okay. If you're a right winger, you can just reinvent history to your liking.
All it takes is a couple bombs, and all of America will be dead within a year, less than a year, just months. Rick, I'm sorry. I don't want to take your time. You're my guest. And I got too carried away here. I can't tolerate this much longer. I can't tolerate it.
He can't tolerate Bernie Sanders running for president. He can't tolerate it. Damn it. Yeah, I'm sorry, Gerald. Gerald says if we don't get the Hitler pool reinstated, I'm going to go bust for sure. You give it a day or so. Oh, that's true. That's true. Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions, noting, come on, Bob, the faith hustlers know how to peddle fear. Well, that and potato soup and 5-gallon buckets of pudding. You know, that 5-gallon bucket of chocolate pudding has got to be absolutely disgusting to behold, don't you think? And I can't think the I can't think the potato soup is that much further ahead. You're right, Gerald. Jim Baker doesn't have to tolerate it. He can vote for someone else. Of course, Jim Baker's operating out of Missouri, so I'm guessing he's a Cruz guy. Just guessing, but I am. I'm guessing he's a Cruz guy. And yeah, this is stupid. Equating Bernie Sanders with Adolf Hitler, for God's sakes. And we can laugh and we can chuckle. But we cannot escape the fact that there are people who do not know any better. Yeah, Marveline, that's what I was thinking all along. That Bernie Sanders, he's just like Adolf Hitler. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's this business he did? Jim Baker said, all it takes is a couple of bombs and all of America will be dead within a year, less than a year, just months. Bernie has bombs? Or... Oh, wait, it's going to be Iran, isn't it? No, maybe North Korea. Bernie's North Korean? Yeah, okay. So we got that. Yeah, but then there's this. Because this is just weird. And this sort of dovetails with the AIPAC business. I don't know what's going on inside that campaign. Is Bill Clinton losing it? I honest to Jesus don't know. Because he's saying some weird stuff. I mean, again, you recall the way that Dr. First Lady Senator Clinton tried to smear Bernie for ever having dared to criticize Barack Obama. Now, this is from a speech today in Washington State. And for the life, I mean, this, as a buddy of mine says, this beats cats fucking. This is, well, listen for yourself. Never mind my commentary. Courtesy of Mediaite.
I literally, from the time I met her 45 years ago till we talked yesterday, she is the best change maker I have ever known. She always finds a way to make something good happen, to make people feel empowered, to buy people into the process, to make democracy work the way the framers intended for it to work. Now, if you don't believe we can all grow together again, if you don't believe we're ever going to grow again, if you believe it's more important to relitigate the past, there may be many reasons that you don't want to support.
Okay, so hold up. What are those dog whistles we're hearing? if you believe it's more important to relitigate the past, what does that dog whistle mean? Well, that's a dog whistle that says we can't talk about any of the terrible things that Bill Clinton did in his presidency, and I ain't talking nothing about no sexy time. I'm talking about the horrible error, the intentional imposition of an economic disaster on this country that was called NAFTA. I'm talking about what happened when they supported the rise of the for-profit prison industrial complex. I'm talking about mandatory minimums. I'm talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. I'm talking about the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Is it relitigating the past to look back at that and say, oh, there's a mistake we really ought not make again? Or is he talking about his spouse's Iraq war vote? Is that what that dog whistle is about? Relitigating the past? Because I don't think the Iraq war is the past yet, do you? Ah, exactly. Labor man in the chat room says, means we're looking forward, not back. But the Iraq war is not relitigating the past. By God, I think the Iraq war needs to stay in our present for a century, maybe for two if we're still around that long, as a bloody reminder of something we should never, ever, 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 ever do again. A mistake that we should never make again. Relitigate the past. And see, there, as Carol points out, there's the problem. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, i.e. her Iraq war vote. As Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue. If you believe it's more important to relitigate the past, there may be many reasons you don't want to support her. But here comes the sales pitch. Here comes the closer. Here comes the money shot. Probably ought not use that phrase.
But if you believe we can all rise together, if you believe we've finally come to the point where we can put the awful legacy of the last 8 years behind us and the 7 years before that when we were practicing trickle-down economics and no regulation in Washington, which is what caused the crash, then you should vote for her.
You got that? Now, in that pageant, suggesting that maybe Barack Obama could have responded differently to a couple of different issues which Bernie criticized him, well, that was intolerable. And if looks could kill, Bernie would have gone away in pieces in a basket. The hiding that Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton gave him for that. But here, today, in Washington State, in something that's not a joke, this is not satire, this is not parody, this is real. Bill Clinton said, if you believe we've finally come to the point where we can put the awful legacy of the last 8 years behind us, well, the Congress of the United States has no legacy. The loony bin House has no legacy. The present right-wing majority in the Senate has no legacy. There's only one person in the last 8 years who has a legacy, and that is Barack Obama. Here's a fun little thought experiment. Imagine him saying that in Mississippi. Imagine him saying that in South Carolina. Imagine him saying that in Alabama or Tennessee or North Carolina or Georgia. Imagine him saying that anywhere in the Confederacy. You can't, because he wouldn't have. Oh, but now he's up there in Washington State. Huh? Huh? The awful legacy of the last 8 years. Yeah. Take that to heart.
Where we can put the awful legacy of the last 8 years behind us and the 7 years before that when we were practicing trickle-down economics and no regulation in Washington, which is what caused the crash, then you should vote for her because she's the only person who basically has good ideas, will tell you how she's going to pay for them, can be commander-in-chief, and is a proven change-maker with Republicans and Democrats and independents alike.
Now you understand why the New York Times article had to be altered. You know, who can get things done with Congress. The only thing is, Bernie Sanders has a long and admirable history of actually getting things done with Congress. And when that little New York Times article came out pointing that out, it had to go. By the way, there's another dog whistle there. The 7 years before that, when we were practicing trickle-down economics and no regulation in Washington, which is what caused the crash, that's another way of saying, God damn it! Wait a minute. God damn it, quit talking about Glass-Steagall. I hate that. You keep talking about Glass-Steagall like it's something I did. Well, it is something I did, but it didn't have nothing to do with the crash. I mean, letting the banks go wild like a drunk with a pocket full of $100 bills in a strip joint, that didn't cause the crash. I mean, even though they was playing with trillions of dollars, not $100 bills, that didn't cause a crash. I didn't cause a crash. We can't relitigate the past. All of a sudden, isn't this interesting? That Hillary Clinton's campaign is, and he doesn't like it. William Jefferson Clinton does not like the fact that her campaign is being held up as a referendum on his presidency. God damn it, I've already got a library and everything. So now he's using stump speeches to try to deflect criticism from his own neoliberal mistakes as president. She can be commander-in-chief. Bernie, he can't be commander-in-chief. He's socialist. You think you want a socialist for commander-in-chief? He probably don't even want to bomb any brown people. Well, that's what America's best at. This is sickening. Well and truly sickening. Wonder how the Kenyan Muslim, you slurper, feels about having his legacy described as awful, the awful legacy of the last 8 years. I wish I could say this is shocking. This isn't shocking. This isn't shocking at all. And I guess there's a sort of a pageant thing going on tonight. Have I already been preempted? I don't know. All five candidates are getting together for some sort of town hall forum. Okay. Or does that start at 9 or something? I honestly don't know. Question coming from Darlene. Democracy Now! Reported this morning that Bernie was not attending the AIPAC meeting because he was in the midst of heavy campaigning, but that he had attempted to gain permission to speak to AIPAC via TV satellite. Apparently his request was declined. Do you know what that was all about? Was his campaign trying to cover itself to deflect the spears that might be coming? I think there might be a little bit of that. I have a heavy campaign schedule. But I don't think Bernie wanted to be there in the first place. And the fact that he said that he... No. AIPAC's important, damn it. You have to come and kiss the ring personally. You can't appear by TV. There probably is... there probably is a little aspect of butt covering going on there. And I don't blame him for it. I mean, it would be political suicide to say I wouldn't set foot in there for all the money, all the gold in Fort Knox or whatever. So, I mean, that makes sense to me. Thank you very kindly to Bob in Texas. Bob has put a $50 challenge on the table that I just now saw in my email. Thank you very kindly, Bob. There's $50 that will match the next $50 that come in, and that's a huge help. People respond to these challenges. Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much indeed. And if that challenge gets met, that'll mean just $100 to go. Thank you. Thank you indeed. So your 5 becomes 10, 10, 20, 20, 40. Your 50 becomes 100. Whatever happened, the first 50 bucks that come in will be matched by Bob in Texas. Thank you, Bob. Thank you again. James asking a question, why the last 8 years and not the last 6? Well, those last 8 years, I don't know. I think there's probably moments why did you say that? Oh, okay, it was an hour-long event set to begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, March 21st. Okay, so it started 49 minutes ago. All right. Thanks, Sparky. Thank you. Yeah, why the last 8 years? Why 8 and 7? Why not the... I mean, if you want to talk about... the crash, why not talk about the last 15? Don't know. Really don't know. Oh, 3-hour event, so there'll be 2 more hours of it once we're off the air here. Thanks again, Sparky. So, I think I'm going to hang on to that clip. I think it might be beneficial. And one last little thing. I had this for Friday. Didn't get around to it. How quickly we have sort of let slide the coo-coo-coo in the bird sanctuary. It's all sort of slipped away, hasn't it? Yeah, well, it turns out that when Lavoie Finkham was making his mad dash for freedom, Wolverines, that one of his passengers was recording the whole thing. And so we now have the last minutes of Lavoy Finkham as he went down the road trying to evade the local law enforcement. You remember how all the right-wingers said, they killed him in cold blood. Well, it turns out, no, not really. Here we go.
Shoot me, you shoot me. I'm going to meet the sheriff. The sheriff is waiting for us. So you do as you damn well please. But I'm not going anywhere. Here I am, right there. Right there, put a bullet through it. You understand? I'm going to go meet the sheriff. You back down or you kill me now. Go ahead, put the bullet through me. I don't care.
Where's Ryan?
I'm going to go meet the sheriff. You do as you damn well please.
Now, remember, the sheriff that Lavoy Finkham was going to go meet was another one of these seditious types in another county over where they were hoping to build support for their little insurrection. You heard that there, though, right? Now, that's a law enforcement officer he's yelling at, saying, kill me now, kill me now. You do not have to shoot me now. You can take me home and shoot me later. Yes, he does. Shoot me now. Pronoun trouble. Daffy fucking duck. Yep. Let's continue.
What for?
Well, I'm going to ask them if they want to go out.
What for? Why are we getting
you
out?
You want out?
What for? What are we getting out?
Who are you? Yeah, who are you? Who are you? Who are you?
Who?
Oregon State Police.
Okay, well, I'm going over to meet the sheriff in Grand County. You'll come along with us, and you'll talk with us over there. You can go ahead and shoot me. Put the laser right there. Put the bullet through the head. Okay, boys? This is going to get real. You want my blood on your hands? Get it done, because we got people to see and place.
Duck season. Wabbit season. Finkham season.
This is a go. No, I don't.
You need to back off.
You need to back off.
Where in the heck is Ammon?
You shouldn't have ever stopped.
Did Ammon?
You're wasting oxygen, son.
Where they got a...
Now there's a cruiser behind them with their flashers on. And again, here's another one of those little thought experiments I like to engage in. Take Lavoy Finkham's white skin and melanize it a little bit. Right? Imagine Lavoy Finkham as a black man screaming, back off! You need to back off! Who are you? You're wasting oxygen, boy, son. Put a bullet, put the laser on me. Put a bullet right here. Yeah.
What? Oh, did they have Ryan? Did they arrest him?
So this goes on. This is the first stop. This is where when ammonium nitrate Bundy gets taken. Then he goes off on a running. He goes off. Yep.
Get your tires out. Stay down.
Is he dead?
Don't get out. I am dead.
Oh wait.
Calling
you. They did it because
there's no service here.
They know there's no service here at all. We should never have stopped.
I'm going to keep going.
Then we have to duck.
I know.
What are they going to do with Ryan?
Okay.
If we take
duck.
Over,
get Ryan back.
Shoot your tires out.
Okay, Ryan Ammon.
Where's
Why did they pull you over?
There's no service here.
Just because.
Okay, you ready?
Well, where's those where's the guns?
They got him stopped. He can't get around it. I'm going to go. You guys ready?
Okay, get down.
Yeah, see, that's the whole point. As Carol points out, imagine Lavoy Finkham as a black man. Laquan Finkham would have been dead a whole hell of a lot quicker.
Duck down. Give me that camera. Okay, give me this camera. Go.
Okay, so he's taken off. He's on the run.
Got it. Are they shooting? Got it.
Still running.
Okay, so they're shooting. Okay,
that's where he gets pulled into the snow. He plows into.
Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down. Stay down.
You can hear him. He's still hollering. Shoot me, shoot me.
Damn it. Are they shooting him? Did I shoot him? You asshole. Oh, my God! Up there. Stay down.
Is he dead?
Don't get out.
I am dead!
Yeah. Having a hard time working up a lot of sympathy. I mean, how many times does a privileged white guy get to yell "shoot me" at the cops before they get all Men in Black, you know, alien bug? Zed, we have a bug, and they say, "Offer accepted." Jesus, the stupid was strong with this bunch. So I thought, you know, I thought just from the perspective of a thought experiment that we should take a moment with that just to remember how much slack gets cut to a cranky old gut, armed to the teeth, white guy. They killed Lavoie. Bastards. Oh, I know that's going to make me seem very unsympathetic, but somehow when I imagine this side by side with, say, Eric Garner or Walter Scott or Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin, yeah, my sympathy goes right down the drain for old Lavoie. All he had to do was peaceably get out of the car with his hands in the air. And he's alive to this day. But he wanted to be killed because he wanted to be a martyr. And now he is. He is a martyr to his own stupidity. And a martyr to the manifest stupidity of the right wing in this country. Somewhere, somebody's probably building a statue. Jesus. Yeah, I figured as much. Carol letting me know.
Alex Jones says, the audio proves it was murder.
No, it doesn't. It proves that Lavoie Finkham was a dumbass. A very privileged dumbass. Who died because he wanted to. So we certainly have ended on a moran note, have we not? Yes. So thank you all very much for joining in for this Moran Monday. Thank you very kindly, Bob in Texas, for putting that $50 challenge on the table. Hopefully it will be met in short order. And we'll be back with Titanic Tuesday tomorrow. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you. Good night, y'all.